So this is number 26, part 2 of The Woman and the Dragon in Revelation chapter 12. It's a frame of reference, what we discussed last week. We have three characters that appear in this chapter. The first is the woman, and we identified this as God's people throughout history. It's not just Israel or not just the church, but all of God's people as they exist throughout history. And the dragon is the oppressor of God's people, again, throughout history. It's not just a particular point in time, but rather represents the oppressor of God's people. The male child we've identified as Jesus. It's quite clear from the description given that the male child is Jesus. And the woman is the first sign, the dragon is the second sign, the male child is not the third sign. The third sign is going to appear in chapter 15. The chapters 12 through about chapter 18, 19 is a single unit. It's all revolving around essentially the same theme. And there are three signs that appear in this unit. Some of the activities that were described in chapter 12 that we discussed is this dragon's tail sweeping down a third of the stars. This is most directly an allusion to a passage in Daniel where the oppressor persecutes the saints of God. And so this is not really an allegory about Satan taking down a third of the angels, but rather it is about persecution of the saints. And we discussed that stars have an ambiguous identification in Revelation. It is most frequently referred to as angels, but an angel simply means a messenger of God, and it can refer to a supernatural being. It can also refer to a person, a human being. The birth that is described in the first part of chapter 12 is not the literal birth of Jesus, but it is actually referring to the death and resurrection of Jesus. So this birth is actually a death.
As in, the birth is the event of Jesus.
Of the culmination of his life.
Right.
Of his victory.
It's right. It's giving birth to victory. It's giving birth to a new spiritual reality.
Right.
And this male child, after his birth, a literal death, is then caught up to God in his throne. This is the ascension of Jesus into glory. And this is an allusion back to Revelation chapter 5, verse 6, where Jesus is described as the lamb and the lion who is now worthy to open the seals. And the woman flees into the wilderness. And this is an allusion to back to Exodus, where Israel spent a significant period of time in the wilderness. For John, the Exodus, because John is a Jewish writer, the Exodus is kind of the fulcrum of his identity. And now he's bringing that forward into his church experience. We discussed a number of structures of Revelation 12. We actually discussed four of them, but we'll review two of them here. The first is the allegorical outline. Well, this is maybe perhaps be the most familiar to most people here. In this outline, there are three different events that are described. Verses 1 through 6 describe Jesus' incarnation, crucifixion, and ascension. Verses 7 through 12 describe a prehistoric war in heaven. And verses 13 through 17 describe the Christian church. A second way of structuring Revelation 12 is in four parts, and it takes this chapter as simply a narrative, a dramatic narrative, where verses 1 through 6 is a confrontation between the dragon and the woman. Verses 7 through 9 is a war in heaven between Michael and the dragon that takes place after the confrontation. Verses 10 through 12 is a commentary by a great voice in heaven about what is happening. And verses 13 through 18 is a continuation of the confrontation between the dragon and the woman that began in verses 1 through 6. We discussed a number of background materials that John probably, you know, whether consciously or unconsciously, brought into the text of Revelation. Greek and Roman mythology had gods giving birth of the offspring spending time in refuge and then returning to conquer. There are similar Egyptian myths. Well, there are certainly Old Testament prophets that wrote using similar motifs. There were Canaanite mythologies regarding sea and sea monsters, you know, serpents, dragons, or Leviathan, this great being of chaos that has to be subdued. The Roman emperor was regarded as a divine savior. And, of course, you know, these Roman and Greek mythologies also had battles among gods, demigods, and so forth, and losers being thrown out or being banished from the heavenly realms. And so all of these imagery would be very familiar to the audience of John. It's describing a cosmic conflict between the great powers. And so with that background, with that frame of reference, that little review, let's read the remaining verses of chapter 12. Now war arose in heaven, Michael and his angels fighting against the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought back, but he was defeated, and there was no longer any place for them in heaven. And the great dragon was thrown down, that ancient serpent, who is called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. He was thrown down to the earth, and his angels were thrown down with him. And I heard a loud voice in heaven saying, Now the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ have come, for the accuser of our brothers has been thrown down, who accuses them day and night before our God. And they have conquered him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, for they loved not their lives even unto death. And therefore rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them. But woe to you, O earth and sea, for the devil has come down to you in great wrath, because he knows that his time is short. And when the dragon saw that he had been thrown down to the earth, he pursued the woman who had given birth to the male child. But the woman was given the two wings of the great eagle, so that she might fly from the serpent into the wilderness, the place where she is to be nourished for a time and times and half a time. The serpent poured water like a river out of his mouth after the woman to sweep her away with a flood. But the earth came to the help of the woman, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed the river that the dragon had poured from his mouth. Then the dragon became furious with the woman and went off to make war on the rest of her offspring, on those who keep the commandments of God and hold the testimony of Jesus. And he stood on the sand of the sea.
So you have nine people looking like creatures.
Yeah, it's fantasy at its finest. So the text describes a war in heaven. From an allegorical perspective, this would be seen as a prehistoric war in heaven between God and Satan. And where in the world did that view come from? First source is John Milton's Paradise Lost, which was written in the 17th century. Second source, perhaps influenced by John Milton, is Jonathan Edwards' sermon, Wisdom Displayed in Salvation. This is from the 18th century. And of course, probably both of these would have been influenced to some degree by Greek mythologies of warring gods. So, history appears to show that this idea of Revelation 12, war in heaven, being something that happened prior to the history of the earth is a fairly recent concept.
Recent in what regard?
As in 17th and 18th century, rather than 1st and 2nd century.
Right. Okay.
The people who originally heard it likely did not think of this war in heaven as being something that happened.
Correct.
Like before creation.
What did they think? It was...
That's option two here. It's a symbolic war between Michael and Satan. It follows Jesus' victory on the cross, thus showing Satan has no legitimate claim to power. Now, whatever claims that he had regarding God, regarding himself, regarding God's people, Jesus demonstrated that is no longer legitimate. And this war is symbolic of all claim. This war and Satan being cast out is symbolic of all the claims by Satan to his legitimacy as part of heaven now being cast out of the heavenly court. So remember that the ancients had in view kind of a heavenly court. We see that in the book of Job, the opening chapter. The sons of God, the different princes that are thought to exist gathering together in the heavenly court, of whom Satan is one of them.
So John is writing Revelation in the 1st century?
Yeah.
He's writing it.
Late 1st.
So people that read it in the 1st century would have thought these other options.
Mm-hmm. Probably.
Not
other options being one or two?
Two.
So are we saying that the people of the 1st century did not believe in a remote, real heaven?
They...
I'm not sure.
The idea of an afterlife and heaven was still in development in Jewish thought during this period.
Some of the Jews believed in an afterlife and some didn't, right?
Correct.
So what exactly that afterlife looked like was maybe fuzzy. Just a minute. Huh.
You could spend a lifetime just on that one question.
Yeah.
But from what John's saying in his theatrics, is he's saying that, like, the victory is the metaphor all together is that the never ending ladder that you're supposed to climb, so Satan's there telling God's people every day that they're not good enough, and that their ladder has to be taller, and that their ways have to be stricter, and they have to conform more and more and more to this ideology before they can be in the presence of heaven. And so God's being vindicated by striking that down and saying, no, your place with me is here, and always has been. And so your idea of an afterlife is not necessarily your focal point. It's more the relationship between you and I is our point of reference, and So that's not in there because the point is not of the afterlife, it's of the relationship between God and his people and what he has brought forth to give us that by casting out the judgment, or not judgment, but the blame or the guilt that you're not able to be in the presence of such a creator. Is he right?
Yeah, I think so. At least that's part of it. What John is really doing here is bringing the old mythologies about wars between the gods and the losers being cast out of heaven, bringing it into Christian thought and applying it to what Jesus accomplished.
And the opposer of Jesus is defeated, cast down. His claims are made known.
The name Michael is literally Mika'el, which is a question. Who is like El? El being the supreme deity, God.
Is that a statement? Or who is like God? Or who is like God?
It's a question. And Mika'el is a counterpart to Satan El, which Satan means adversary.
So adversary
or opposer of El, or God. And Satan El as a name is found not in Bible, but in other Jewish literature of that time.
Yeah, I'm still way back, 3 miles back, but didn't you say that in the first century that Christianity was still developing a concept regarding
Jews were.
Okay. Jews were developing a...
Jews were still working. They weren't... There was no singular agreement as to whether or not there was an afterlife, and if there was, what that would be.
Okay. But Christians did believe in an afterlife. They believed
that
there was going to be somebody to rescue them, though.
Well, made true quantum steps. Okay. Jews were not unified on an afterlife. The Jews were not unified on a physical remote heaven.
Correct.
Were the Christians unified on a remote physical heaven? Or is it more like what Ray was saying is it's not a physical world we're seeking, but rather a relationship we're seeking.
Well, it was probably developing. What we read in Paul, though, is Paul seems to have a very clear indication that there is going to be this resurrection that happens, and a recreation of the earth that happens. That the saints will be reunited with God. Now, whether that happens on the earth
or somewhere
else, it may be a little ambiguous.
Mm-hmm. Well, the concept that you're presenting is that reality, I don't know how you would say this, because I'm an engineer, but you're saying that the reality of a remote, real world is a concept that's being developed. And that's
just not an assumption of the people hearing this.
Ancient mythology, Jews included, believed in three layers: heaven, earth, and the underworld.
Okay. So there was
heaven was the residence of the gods. Earth is the residence of humans. The underworld is the residence of demons.
And in our enlightened state, because we are so smart, we kind of say that we can understand what they thought, but we know they weren't right. Because what we believe today is absolutely true. It's fact. It's 1 plus 1 equals 2. It's fact. But what you're implying, I'm not implying, but what I'm hearing a little bit is reality is being developed rather than being discovered.
No. We went through this when you were gone, so it's really difficult because...
Yeah.
When John explains how the victory became in Revelations, he explains the difference between the realm of heaven, the lives of man, and the eternity of the relationship between God. And what he explains is there was a time before this time that man had no relationship with God. That the devil was in the details, and that man could no longer carry himself in the light of God unless he followed strictly to this regiment. And then what was happened is the resurrection of Christ made it so that man could now see God, could now have a relationship with him. The most inner part of the temple was open to all to see.
Right.
Not just the holiest of holies were allowed to see God anymore, but every man, every creature on the planet had the ability to now see in the infinite possibility of God. As
well, what I think I hear you
was
say...
Was that last week or the week before?
The week before.
That was one of the possible interpretations of it. But...
And it's not saying that...
11:19, when God's temple was opened and the Ark of His Covenant was seen within His temple.
See, it's not that heaven didn't exist. It's not that there is no... that this is being tailored to the generation that each person can assume that this is something that they're going to create in their own vision. This is something that's actually being given to these people at this time that previously did not even have it. They had
what
no choice.
Given?
A relationship with God. An actual ability to see that you are a creation of His glory, and that you are capable and made to be part of His life.
So what I think I hear you saying is that somebody, I don't know if it's the Christians or the current day or whatever, what era, it's focusing on a relationship and the reality of a real physical heaven and all that may or may not is not the focus, regardless if it does or
right.
doesn't exist.
It's irrelevant.
Okay.
John probably doesn't know any better. You know, he believes in the reality of the realm of the gods, the realm of man, the realm of demons. And he is using what he knows to describe what he has been shown.
But the physical reality, he didn't know any better. Well, we know better. Right. We know better as much as he does. We don't know. We honestly don't know what physical reality is. But what I think Ray's saying is that's not the issue. The issue isn't the physical reality. The issue is the relationship.
Right. To be caught up into heaven is to have the opportunity to be with the gods. That is the ancient
gods. And
that's
a relationship.
Yeah.
Whereas I would, if you were asking the blind, I would say Christianity is caught up in the physical. Are you going physically to heaven? It's a physical one. It's not to focus on the relationship. And you're saying that in John's book. Okay. I think I... Okay.
Okay. So, back to the war. Both sides of angels. Just, again... common mythological motif. So you've got the heads of each side, and then they have their followers. So who is Michael? He is described as one of the chief of princes in Daniel chapter 10 and Daniel chapter 12. again, going back to ancient theology and mythology, each nation, each people group had a prince or an angel that they believed represented them in the realm of the gods, or you will say heaven.
Kind of like saints or something.
Kind of. Michael was assigned to the nation of Israel. And so Michael fights on behalf of the ones he is assigned to protect. In Jude verse 9, and in non-canonical Jewish legends, Michael also disputed with the devil in regards to the body of Moses. So, general Protestant thought is that Michael simply represents one of the chief angels.
Let me ask a stupid question. And I think this has probably been one of my problems for the last 60 plus years. Am I correct in saying that Seventh-day Adventists historically would be in group number one, which puts this into physical realms and physical...
Yes.
And that what you're talking about in group number two is I'm not saying one or two is right, and I'm not saying one or two is wrong, but one and two are not necessarily saying the same thing.
Correct.
Okay. So what we're looking at is not a clarification of what historically I would have heard as Seventh-day Adventist beliefs.
That is correct.
And this is a problem that I know that I've had in my head, because whenever I go to sermons, I always think, well, everybody's teaching, what everybody's saying, whatever I read, is always a correct definition of truth, and I try to put it all in the same box, and nobody tells me, no, this is a different box. This is a different box. Now, I'm not going to vote on which box is right or wrong. That's not the issue, but it's a different box.
Yes. So, in regards to Michael now, the identity, Seventh-day Adventists have historically equated Michael with Jesus. Mm-hmm. It's based on some tenuous proof texting. Primary being 1 Thessalonians 4:16, where it reads, "For the Lord himself will descend from heaven with a cry of command, with the voice of an archangel, and with the sound of the trumpet of God, and the dead in Christ will rise first." So this cry of the voice of an archangel, well, Michael is an archangel, therefore Michael must be Jesus.
Because Jesus cries with the voice of an
archangel. And John chapter 5, verses 25 to 29 also describe a similar thing, mm-hmm. where Jesus says he will cry, will sound the voice of an archangel.
So you can't go back to Judaism, because Judaism doesn't believe in Jesus.
It's also based on the interpretation of the name Mikael, not as a question, but as a statement. Who is like God?
As in, who is like God?
Rather than who is like God.
I think you also have to tell about the Church of Israel type thing, too.
What is that?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, Church.
Because John always refers to Israel, but he's really referring to the people that believe in God.
Right. Israel is a spiritual term. It's not a national or a tribal people group. It's a spiritual term for John.
Do you think that John understood or believed? Okay, see, that's two different words. If he understood, that assumes that what I'm saying is fact, and John may or may not have understood it. If he believes, it doesn't mean that. But Jesus was pre-existent to his birth.
Right.
Did John believe that Jesus was God previous to his birth?
Probably.
Of course, John believed everything exactly right. He had truth. We have truth. Therefore.
Well, I guess.
The same, right?
Is there some that believe that Jesus became God or that Jesus was God?
Well, Christian theology too was developing at this same period, and there were different schools of thought.
So that's a valid question. Did Jesus become God or was it?
There were some who would call themselves Christians at that time that believed that God...
That God looked down on a good man and made him into a God.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Wow. Okay, that's possible. That's not exactly where I'm going. But was Jesus our Savior before he became our Savior?
Yes.
Well, yes, as we believe it, yes. But did they believe that? Did John believe that?
That's,
They've always assumed that he did.
I think because John has developed a very strict rhetoric, that coincides and continues to coincide with everything that we've been reading. And I'm going to say back to Stephen because that's where I can remember that everything pertains to the fact that prior to our relationship with God through Christ, man had a very small, very, very pinhole ideology of what they could attain a heaven or a God-like status.
Mm-hmm.
And when, if you want to say God and Jesus decided to discuss whether or not God should have a relationship with man or not, quote-unquote, Jesus convinced himself or God that he needed a relationship with people again and sent himself down to make sure that we were given that chance to be in a relationship with God. And it seems like every time we read any passage, it always comes back to this, yes, God is Jesus, because God and Jesus had to come to the term that we were going to be able to talk to each other. So here he is. Here's your relationship. Do by him and you will be doing with me. And it just goes on and on and on like that forever. Book after book, everything we read seems to just be, you have God because you have Jesus. And it's the chicken before the egg thing forever. You could sit there and do that forever, but it's really just you have him because you were given him. And you're worthy and you're allowed. Otherwise, you can go back to climbing the ladder and never end.
Jehovah's Witnesses also identify Michael as Jesus based on similar reasoning. Of course, the witnesses, they also believe that Jesus is a created being. So that would be the difference between witnesses and Adventists.
Created by who?
Created by God.
Based on the
single verse that mentions Jesus as the first one of creation.
Well, Psalms is the poor reference. Yeah.
And the Latter-day Saints believe Michael is multiple incarnations. Adam, the Ancient of Days, Prince, the Patriarch of the human family, and that he assisted Jehovah in the creation of the world. And so, that's the point, is John doesn't specifically identify Michael as, who he is, and so people have come to different conclusions and identifications as to who this being is that fought the dragon. dragon, on the other hand, is very unambiguous. It's very clear. The serpent, the devil, the Satan, John makes very clear as to who this, what this being is. And this goes back to Genesis chapter 3, where the beginning of sin in the world is identified with a serpent and its deception of the first human beings.
Didn't you say that before this, the serpent wasn't actually ever identified as Satan?
Yes, I believe that's probably true. I can't be certain at this time.
Uh-huh.
But
here, the serpent is clearly... Satan is clearly identified as the serpent.
Right. Up until Christianity, the identity of the serpent was ambiguous. No, it was both good and evil.
You mean serpents in general?
Serpents in general.
Okay.
The healing.
Yeah. They have poison, but they also heal.
Oh, Moses' serpent.
Yeah.
I get that straight, and then
I get so confused with Moses.
And also the Greek god Asclepius, the symbol of the serpent that physicians wear.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
This serpent, this dragon, is cast down to the earth. So, in verse 12, then it can say, "Rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them, but woe to you, O earth and sea." Now, the heavens will no longer be cursed by the serpent, by the dragon. And in verse 4, it read, "His tail swept down a third of the stars of heaven." So, what I read, if we take the narrative option of interpretation, is that prior to Jesus' victory over Satan, Satan's accusations, you might say, had merit to some extent, in that he was able to destroy saints, or at least cast them down to the earth. But now, with Jesus' victory, all of Satan's claims in the realm of heaven has been destroyed, and Satan can no longer hurt those who are in heaven. Satan's sphere is now restricted.
So, in light of what we've been saying, is this war in heaven a physical location, a physical war, or is it a declaration of loss of relationship?
It's a metaphor.
Yeah. So after Jesus died, Michael had the war with Satan. That's when intellectually everybody was able to see who Satan really was.
Yeah.
Or could see who Satan really was.
The accusation.
Does it even need to be tied to a specific time, or is it just referring to the battle that occurs, maybe the battle that occurs between Satan and whoever is representing God, and when Jesus offers sin or whatever?
Well,
It's tied
to a time because of the commentary that follows in verses 10 through 12.
Okay.
Because it says, "And I heard a loud voice in heaven saying, now the salvation and the power and the kingdom of God and the authority of his Christ have come. For the accuser of our brothers has been thrown down, who accuses them day and night before our God."
So it's saying this is what happened when Jesus died and was resurrected, when Jesus conquered.
When that is describing the effect of Jesus' victory over Satan.
That makes sense.
Which could have been just a recognition of what he represents, his motives.
So it's a commentary by a loud voice. Whenever a loud voice occurs in Revelation, something important is being revealed. And what is being revealed is the result of the war that was just described. First, what? What is the result? Salvation, power, kingdom, and authority of God in Christ have now come. So, what it says is that up until that point, Satan's claims had merit. At least they were worth investigating.
They seemed to work.
Yeah. How did this victory come about? Well, Satan has been thrown out of heaven. His merits, his claims have been dismissed. They were claimed to be without merit. They were lies. They were deceptions. And so in the realm of the gods, the realm of heaven, Satan no longer has influence.
I mean, what was Satan's primary revenue? His primary goal was to influence God, saying that man was not pure enough to make it into his realm. To have eyes upon God, man was not worthy. And that's what Satan was cast out for, was because his constant will toward God was that he would not choose a relationship with man, and that man would not choose a relationship with him. Because man wasn't worthy to take presence of God. And that's what he always felt.
So, yeah, why has salvation come? Because Satan can no longer accuse God's people. Satan's primary tool is accusation. And from the background commentary, reads, from his portrayal in the book of Job and on, Satan is presented as an accuser of the righteous, a prosecuting attorney before God's court. In later texts, his role of tempter, gaining incriminating evidence, became more prominent, but he always retained his role as accuser. Later rabbinic texts declare that he accused Israel day and night before God, except on the Day of Atonement. So that was the understanding of Satan and his role in heaven. And John is saying that is done. That is no longer true.
He no longer has the right to accuse God.
Right. But what else? What else? What are the other results? The saints have conquered. What did they conquer? They conquered Satan, the accuser. And how did they conquer? By the blood of the Lamb. This is goes back to chapter 7, verse 14, where it reads, they have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. They have also conquered by their testimony and witness. And what does this testimony and what does this witness mean? It is in relation to John on Patmos on account of testimony. Fifth seal mentions souls that were slain for their witness. And in chapter 11, mentioned two witnesses who finished their testimony. So it has something to do with Jesus, the relationship that the saints have with Jesus. And this idea of saints have conquered goes back to the seven letters to the seven churches. Now, each time there were rewards that were mentioned for conquering. And the verse references are listed, but so already something of this idea of conquering is present now, that saints have conquered and that the rewards that were promised back in the seven letters is about to be given. What about this idea that they loved not their lives even unto death? Is it speaking about martyrdom? What have we talked about martyrdom in the past? We've already established that Revelation is not speaking about individuals, but about the church as a whole. So whenever it talks about saints dying or saints being killed, it is not specifically a martyrdom of individuals, although some may experience such things. But it's talking about the church as a whole. It's talking about a martyr church. the rewards for conquerors in the seven letters do not require martyrdom for the conquerors. And so we can say that this death that's being talked about in this chapter 12 is not an individual loss of life, but rather an experience of the church. It's talking about martyr church, a church that is oppressed, being suffocated, being killed, but still refuses to give up.
What's going through my head is two different things. One is, when you say reward, if you do something in accordance with my directions, I will reward you. On the other hand, there's another type of reward, is if you're climbing Mount Everest, the reward isn't something I give you. The reward is that you achieve the top of Mount Everest. And the battle between God and Satan is, what is the appropriate outline for life? And Jesus came and showed that life is a life of giving, whereas Satan said, you can't have a society of givers because society would fail. Where Satan says, society of laws, regulations, you have to regulate everybody. And so God proved that a life of giving is physically not only possible, but it works. It's right.
The commentary ends with some final implications of this war that took place. First, heaven and its inhabitants can rejoice. And we're left with some questions. Who are these inhabitants of heaven? Are they the sealed servants of God that we've already encountered, the 144,000, the great multitude? And if so, then it would include all the servants of God, dead and alive, throughout history. Or are they only those who no longer physically have life on the earth? Are they dead servants of God?
Well, what if the just created beings had nothing to do with this earth at all?
True.
Because if God's...
But see, where I'm going with this is John has established already that the judgments and the woes that fall on the earth only directly affect those who are not servants of God.
Okay.
The woes and the judgments that fall on those who dwell on the earth affect only those who are not sealed, those who are not servants of God.
But on the other hand, if Satan prevailed, if the serpent prevailed, would not of all the universe collapse? Heaven would collapse.
I'm not sure what that has to do with when.
Okay.
And I think who inhabits heaven is going to become more clear as we continue on in the next chapters. The other implication is that the commentary declares woe to earth and sea. Woe, the word woe was used during the seven trumpets as omens of judgment. These judgments, as I just mentioned, were only for those who were not sealed, in other words, not God's servants. What about this new woe in relation to the devil? Because, devil is cast down to the earth, and from a very literal perspective, all who are living, saints as well as those not sealed, are living on the earth. And so the woe would then be upon everyone, good and evil. But that would run counter to what we have been seeing in the seven trumpets. Dwell on the earth, that phrase in Revelation clearly refers to those who have rejected God. Yet, as the last few verses in chapter 12 show, it appears the woman and her offspring are harassed by the devil. So, who and what, to what extent does this woe affect? Is it everyone, or is it still limited to those who have rejected God? And again, I think subsequent chapters may clear this up. We don't have an answer yet. Chapter 12 is introducing a setting. You know, it's not here to answer all our questions yet.
Where is the dwell on the earth?
Therefore rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them. So by implication, the next sentence, but woe to you, O earth and sea, and those who dwell in them.
Oh, I see. The dwell, it's implied.
It's implied.
In verse 12, got it. Well, and we've always taken that to mean the devil is on the earth eating his fingers.
Yes.
And certainly that is the devil's desire, because you know the devil is enraged. He knows his time is short. And as the last part of this confrontation narrative continues, you know, John describes the resumption of this confrontation, and he once again goes back to Exodus, and the image is there. The Pharaoh's pursuit of Israel. The rescue is said to be on eagle's wings. This is an allusion to Exodus 19, verse 4. Israel finds safety in the wilderness. And you know, they're confronted by they're not confronted by a flood that's coming after them, but a wall of water that's in front of them, the Red Sea. But God opens up a way. You know, so this, John is not, it's not a direct allusion, but it's similar. So John is portraying the church now as going through the same experiences as historical Israel. Verses 6 and 14 are parallel. And then verse 6 says, nourished for 1260 days. And verse 14 says, nourished for time, times, and half a time, both referring to the same time period. So this clearly ties together the first and last parts of chapter 12. The last part is a continuation of the first part. And this time, the 1260 days, the time, times, and half a time, is the time that the devil has. You know, he knows his time is short. And this is made clear in the next chapter, 13 verse 5. Verse 15, the river out of its mouth, something coming out of the mouth, we have already seen in Revelation, you know, that's sword coming out of Jesus' mouth, representing Jesus' words, the gospel message, his testimony. This river then is most likely words from Satan. No, not a physical flood, but words. Lies, falsehoods, deceptions, and accusations. These are the tools of Satan that he tries to drown, that he uses to try to drown the woman. Verse 16, the earth came to the help of the woman. And this image goes back to Jewish tradition. In Jewish tradition, creation loyal to God sometimes helped the righteous against their wicked human oppressors. Thus, for example, a tree hid Isaiah from his pursuers, and the earth swallowed and so hid the vessels of the temple. These are Jewish legends. John is simply, again, referring to some of the common stories of
Elijah
this time.
Was protected by a raven.
Yeah.
As in, God's creation is loyal to God's people.
But it appears the devil cannot touch the woman, so he next goes after her offspring. Can the devil? So questions are raised and are not answered. Can the devil touch the woman's offspring? Are they part of those who dwell on the earth? In other words, are the offspring part of those who dwell on the earth, or are they not? And what does it mean to keep the commandments of God and hold the testimony of Jesus?
What did you think? Let me turn on the recorder.
No answer this time. It's just questions.
No. Come on, tell it.
So in summary of chapter 12, it makes sense as a dramatic narrative. The allegorical view certainly could be said to make sense as well, but the dramatic narrative may make better sense. First section describes how things were on earth. God's people were being accused by the dragon. A male child appears from out of God's people, the woman. Satan tries to prevent Jesus from accomplishing his purpose. He was ready to devour the child. But then Jesus' death and resurrection actually turn out to be the birth of a new spiritual reality, a victory over Satan. Jesus ascends to heaven and his people flee for protection. The second section, verses 7 through 9, describe what happened in heaven as a result of Jesus' victory. Satan loses all claim to legitimacy and power that he was using to accuse God's people. And Satan is restricted to just the earth and the sea. He is no longer allowed in the heavenly realms. The third section, verses 10 through 12, is an explanation giving the implications of the victory. God's power and authority are vindicated. His people have conquered because of Jesus and their testimony from and about him. Heaven can now rejoice, and who does heaven include? Does it include God's people? That's a question that is not answered yet. On the other hand, woe to the earth and the sea. And again, what comprises earth and the sea? Is it just those people that are not God's servants? Or does it include God's servants who are still alive on the earth? And verse 12 is a transition that ties this third section, the commentary, to the fourth section, the resumption of the narrative that left off in verse 6. So, fourth section, verses 13 through 17. The dragon continues to pursue the woman to try to destroy her, but she is rescued. And we get additional details about how the woman gets to the wilderness that was left out of section 1. And we see that this woman spends a period of time in the wilderness. The dragon attempts to harm the woman, but is circumvented. The dragon cannot harm the woman. And so, enraged, he goes off to make war with the rest of the woman's offspring. And that's where the chapter ends. And as good drama, suspense builds as the audience wonders what the dragon will do and what will happen to the woman's offspring. It's a cliffhanger.
There's the dragon on the loose.
Also, who are the offspring?
Who are the offspring, yeah. Well, we know who the offspring are, but where are they? That's the question.
Who are the offspring of the woman? If the woman is the church, are the offspring the people that are going to come to the church but haven't yet?
Well, they are those who keep the commandments of God and hold the testimony of Jesus.
But he won't answer that.
So they represent God's people in some way.
So the church is, so the woman is like the original church.
Or the woman is the church as a whole, and
the woman is God's people throughout history.
Right.
And
the dragon cannot harm the woman. Well, if the woman is the church, then he could.
The offspring would be the same.
I thought the dragon was not allowed to harm Jesus.
No, the dragon was not allowed to harm the woman. He was not allowed to harm the male child either.
Right, but so who's the woman? If the dragon's not allowed to harm the woman, and the woman's not Jesus, who's the woman?
The woman is described in terms of Israel.
God's people.
And for John, Israel represents God's people, regardless of nationality.
So we're still unclear on what is meant by offspring.
Yeah.
Well, the first of her offspring was Jesus.
But she has more offspring.
She has more offspring.
Jesus' younger siblings.
Maybe it's best not, again, Revelation is not to be taken as an allegory, so there may be duplications of symbols.
Well, I'm back with what Ray, because I have lost my anchor. I always thought that the devil failed when Jesus succeeded. Therefore, he went out to make war with the church. But you're right. This says he made war with the offspring of the church.
Correct.
I think we have to wait, though, Jerry, for real, because John's been like throwing us off the cliff.
This is drama. This is drama. This is like, you know, a weekly TV show with series.
Seriously, John has thrown us off the cliff almost
this
every
is like
time.
The lid is in the cocoon for how many episodes? What is she going to look like when she comes out?
Yeah, because on the last chapter we read, well, we're always left wondering who is and what is almost every time, and then we start reading again and we find out.
Yeah, Revelation is not systematic theology, it's drama. It was meant to be read, and so it has to hold the audience's attention. So John uses plot devices that will hold the audience's attention.
Now, at first, that's where it is, because last week we were like, totally sure we knew who the woman was, and this is all apparent, this is making sense, and then suddenly we're back to the, wait a minute, what, the woman is Israel again, right? And so we're kind of not, we're sure, but...
Well, the woman is Israel, but, you know, Israel, what does Israel mean in Revelation?
That's right.
And what does the offspring of Israel mean?
We've been through that one kind of twice, too.
So Revelation continues to be a story that engages both the intellect and the emotions. We wonder what's happening, but it also is supposed to engage our emotions, our heart. It uses familiar, at least to John's audience, narratives and themes, and repurposes them. He brings new meaning to what is familiar. We see that with... We do that with our stories.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you see the great stories that have been told in modern times.
It makes sense to us, though. But you think about 1,000 years from now,
and
stories that we've confused.
You know, when we bring, let's say, themes from World War II into a modern adaptation of some story, we don't intend allegory, at least not usually, unless we specifically write an allegory. No, so in other words, we don't intend for every element to have a correspondence between then and now.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with Revelation. It's about how, you know, by using the familiar, we hope to raise certain emotional feelings. We hope to engage the audience in some way. This is what John is doing. And so we have to get into the minds of the ancients as much as we possibly can and try to read Revelation in the same way.
You thought you could do this with us? Little did you know.
Oh, he knew.